I'm Bill Lennon, and I'm going to begin a series of interactions talking about sexual misconduct in churches this week. And I'd like to give you just a little bit of a flavor, not much, of what we're going to do. I'm going to talk just a little bit about some of the work that I do, and then do something of an overall perspective about some things that are happening in society. And my reason for doing that, some of it you will already know and be more familiar with that, is that it's important to me to move that from society into the churches and make sure that we make that connection. I'm a member of a group, Marriage, Child, and Family Therapists, and we do what we call garden variety marriage, child, and family issues. We have a specialty area where we work with compulsive sexual behavior and sexual abuse behavior, which really is two different stratas, two different levels. I'm not going to talk much about that today, but if some of you want to ask me about that at some point in time, just because we have some real time constraints, but we work with the whole gamut. And I've done that work for 11 years now, where I've been working with family incest treatment programs and so forth and so on. I started a program in Tacoma, Washington at a place called Christos Counseling Center, where we had a family incest treatment program, and we also have one in Bellevue. I've also done some graduate school teaching, about 15 years, where I was head of a clinical psych department, and many of the offenders that I work with. When I say offenders, in that sense, I'm talking about people that are ordered by the court. So in most of those cases, those are child molesters. And in most of those cases, they're males. Not always, but the highest percentage of them. And most of the talking I'll do today, when I make references, I was real sensitive to what Dan was saying about using inclusive language at all levels. The truth of the matter is that most adjudicated child molesters, for instance, are males, nearly 80%. That doesn't necessarily, actually about 78%. That doesn't necessarily mean that's the right ratio, and that's a whole other talk and topic. But because of that, when I speak of an offender, I will speak of male. Even though in the program I work with right now, I'm working with, I think, three females. I get a lot of referrals from the Christian community. That's real important for me to say. And the reason it's real important for me to say is that I want to hammer for the first 15 minutes of this presentation the idea that everything crosses cultures, everything crosses age ranges. And I didn't use sexual abuse, I used sexual misconduct, because I want to keep it broader and keep it as generic as I can in the things that I'm presenting today. And I want you to at least get the understanding that in my work, I work with as many pastors and school teachers who are involved in, and that's two groups that I happen to get a lot of referrals to come for, either by court or by self-referral. I have as many pastors and school teachers as I have dentists and bricklayers and name the function that you want. That's real important to keep in mind, because it seems to me, and that's all I can say, is it seems to me, I don't have any data on this at all, and for the next few minutes I'm going to say a few data points. It seems to me that I know pretty intuitively, and that most everybody I know pretty intuitively senses that these kinds of sexual misconduct, inappropriate boundary crossings, sort of can hit everybody all across cultures until you bring it home. But then when you bring it home, it couldn't be my pastor. It couldn't be our Sunday school teacher. It couldn't be the teacher that I, you know, that it's like we know it, but we don't know it. And I run into that constantly. And a little bit of what I'm going to talk about today, and I will have to condense that quite a bit, is aimed at trying to get across the idea that although I will talk some about why people, the profile of why people get into those kinds of behaviors, I hope you'll walk away with two things about that. One is that we're looking to explain the behavior but not to excuse it, because there isn't any excuse. There is no excuse. If you walk away with the idea that I have at any level excused any kind of sexual misconduct, then I've been softer than I mean to be, because I laugh with the people, and we laugh a lot in our program, people we work with, but I tell them, you touch a kid or you cross a line and nobody will put you in jail faster than I will. I'm very, very stringent about that. But we do look at trying to understand the behavior, and the reason it's so crucial to understand the behavior is because it's a progressive disease, and if you don't break the cycle, it will go on and on and on and on, and it never stops. And you can't put people in jail that long, because at least the way the laws are set, and probably the way the laws ought to be set, is that you can only be in jail for as long as whatever the amount of time is for what you've done. And no longer than that. And I'd want to be treated that way. The problem is if you've got a progressive disease problem, you will come out and do the same thing again, and again, and again, and again. And that has nothing to do with, and I get in some interesting problems when I make statements like this, but that has little to do with how rich you are, or how intelligent you are, and this is the one I get in trouble with sometimes, or how Christian you are. There's some real difficulties around that. And it's kind of interesting, because somehow, at least as I work with people in the Christian community, even though it's terribly uncomfortable, there's a sense of understanding how a born-again, deeply committed Christian pastor can fall back on cocaine. And after, I know of one that I had some dealings with, I worked with his some other people in his parish, and after 14 years of having that in recovery, went back and did a six-month binge on cocaine. Somehow we can at least grasp that a bit. Much harder to see the same thing if you go back to abusing your parishioners or abusing children. The last point I want to make about that is, when I talk about abusing parishioners or abusing children, I'd really like to look at it in the same light. Not like hierarchically, like it's worse, because I don't see it as worse. It's a process. And the process that I really would like people to try to get a handle on, which is not easy to get, and I'm certainly no theologian, and there's a whole bunch of folks here that understand theology better than me, but I know it's a problem that I have, and that's this concept that sins don't have weight. And it seems to me sins don't have weight except the sexual ones, but the sexual ones have weight. I mean, I don't know how to put that together, but it's like in our society, the person who steals and the person who goes to war and everything, we don't like it, but we forgive them and all. But the person who does sexual sins, that's a little bigger. That's a little different. I don't think it is. I think from a theological standpoint, I don't think God says, you're even and you're even and you're even, a few sex guys are worse. I don't think that's the case. And I don't think it's the case whether the sex thing that you do is with a child or with a someone you're counseling or whatever. So I take it from that standpoint that we're talking about a process that is very destructive, and the process is one that always includes two issues. The two issues are power and vulnerability. Sometimes the power and sometimes the vulnerability are not real obvious. Sometimes they're very obvious. I talked with a pastor. Craig mentioned that he'd seen it on a TV show that I was on, and we didn't get a chance to talk about that story yet, but I talked with that particular pastor, who was a Lutheran pastor in three different congregations in Wisconsin, and had had sexual contact with 16 of his parishioners, three of them adolescents. And in that particular case, and if I hit this too quick, then later yell at me, or we'll try to talk about it or something. The issue that is most destructive and most damaging is not the sexual intercourse, not the penetration. The issue that's the most damaging is the fact that this person that I am vulnerable to, who I trusted, and if he happens to even be a pastor, who I may get confused as to whether that pastor is God or God is pastor or he's my connection or something like that, for whatever his reason, used me sexually. That's the process that's incredibly devastating. So the way I express that is that it's a power abuse, and in the dysfunction of that power abuser, that particular dysfunctional person power abuses in a sexual way. But it's the power abuse by using you sexually to make me feel good that is incredibly destructive to the recipient. I worked with two women. I'll call them Sally and Jean, and for me they demonstrated that particular story very well, and I want to make sure that I hammer that particular point home. In that particular case, Sally came to see me, oh, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. And, you know, I used to learn when I was a high school counselor, when they don't ever come in and say, I'm pregnant. They come in and say, I want a schedule change, and then 2 hours later you find out that they're pregnant. Well, Sally came in for a totally different reason, although an incredibly interesting one. She came in because she had something that we couldn't figure anything else to call it, so we called it dental phobia. But she couldn't go into a dentist chair. She just couldn't do it. And when she'd get into a dentist chair, she would become incontinent. And, you know, that's pretty humiliating, so she wouldn't go. And then she would live in fear that, you know, someday my teeth are going to fall out. I will have to go to a dentist someday. Incredibly frightened about that. Working with that over a few months, we got to a point where what we discovered, to encapsulate that, was that when she got in a dentist chair and when she would lay back in the chair and be in the power of the dentist, it triggered in her something that she had never told anybody about, but from ages 6 to ages 13, twice a week on-demand intercourse with her grandfather. At age 13, she stopped it. What do you know, it stopped. We worked on that, spent about a year and a half of therapy. Two things happened. One is that she got where she could go in a dentist chair, so we had a graduation point. A friend of mine was a dentist, and we'd go in and practice with his chair, and a lot of different things happened. And that got okay, and the abuse really, as far as I can tell, and I've had contact with her in the last 6 years, twice since then, and she seems to be doing fine. So as far as we know, she really is a well-integrated survivor of sexual misconduct. She really integrated it well. That was an incredible, extreme abuse with a person in a power position and so forth and so on, all of that. Worked with another young woman who came in, and as far as I could tell, and I had lots of contacts with collateral people, and everything seemed to hold up very well. And in that particular case, this young woman, when she was 12 years of age, her dad had been at a drag race, one of these things where you took the hot rod car or something in the back dragging off the pickup, and her dad was driving and had been drinking too much, and she was lying in the front seat of the pickup at age 12. And what he had done was, in something of a drunken stupor, had reached his hand between her legs and touched her vagina. And to my knowledge, that was the one and only incident. I worked with her for 2 years, sometimes 2-3 times a week, through suicidal depressions and so forth and so on. I don't know where she is, but she was an absolute devastated wreck the last time I saw her. Now, my point is that I've worked with victims for years, and that's always the case. I have no idea what the post-traumatic stress disorder will be after it happened. You know, we learned a lot about that, people coming out of Vietnam. Victims are the same way. You cannot at any level make any kind of judgment about the act itself, because what's most devastating, I'll go back to that theme I was developing before, is the fact that someone I trusted, who I was vulnerable to, who was in a position with more power than me, used me sexually, and what they did or how many times they did that is not the issue, although that may be horrible. Have I hammered that one home enough? At least I strongly, strongly believe that. And I find that when I work with victims, that that's really important. In society, in the last 10 years, we're doing much work with families, 8 to 10 years. Lots of work with families, lots of TV programs. Oprah Winfrey says that she was abused. We see The Color Purple. I mean, there's just been a ton of work, a great amount of it, very good. Kids have an awareness. I wish we didn't live in a world where you had to have that kind of an awareness, but kids do have an awareness in many cases of where to go and what to do, and there's a lot of help on the horizon. So we've done a lot of work with families. My sense is about 5 years behind that, but really coming, is the work in the schools. Lots of work is being done in lots of schools, not all of them, but I know here in the state of Washington, I'm running workshops. I've been in 16 school districts now and am getting in more and more, and we're doing trainings and recognition and what to do, and some of the things I'll be doing this week that I do in school trainings, and I know that's happening in a number of other states. The churches were just not having that kind of impact. We just don't much get in the front door. that's obviously not always true. I don't mean it, but I'm talking about globally, it's much, much more difficult to recognize that the number of people who would be involved in power abusive / sexual acts would be just as great and maybe even greater in the church than anywhere else, because the needs of the quote-unquote offender are just as great. The dysfunction is just as great. And yet, statistically, we don't have nearly as many people. And I'm not just talking about pastors here. I don't want to single out pastors, though. I want to talk about Sunday school teachers and the guy who cleans up, the kitchen, and whoever and whoever and whoever. And I also don't want to scare people particularly, because I don't want to ever get to the point where we have to be frightened of this kind of thing, but we really do have to pay attention to it. One example that I use of touching, which I think is very appropriate, in the last Olympics, hopefully I judged right, the American gymnastics coach, I don't know if you know, he's a great big Lithuanian, they call him the Bear. Do you know who I mean? And these little 92-pound wonder little women would come off of doing their routines, and this great big American coach would grab, he was not American, but I mean, grab them and engulf them and hug them and dance with them and everything. And I think that was the most healthy, appropriate thing I've ever seen. I just loved it. I hope he's not a child molester. I thought it was just a wonderful expression of touching and hugging. I don't want to get the idea that that's wrong. Tomorrow I'm going to talk some about particular patterns where I'll get more specific about some of the touching and how to take a look at what's appropriate touching and not appropriate touching. And I'll say once again, it makes me probably as sick as it does you that we even have to pay attention to those kinds of things. But we do have to pay attention to them. Now, let's not go too far. I had a pastor tell me where I gave a talk at his church or with his whole group. It wasn't Lutheran church, so I don't know whether it's synod or whatever it was, but he says, no Sunday school teacher of mine is ever going into the bathroom with a kid again. I said, wait a minute. I'm not saying that. You know, that gets us where it just scares us absolutely to death. But anyway, let me say that there is a pattern, and I'm still talking a little bit generic, but the pattern is one of, and this happens in the, and I'll go through the three that I did. It happens in the schools, it happens in the family, and it happens in the churches. And that's the pattern of the offender, the non-offending partner, and the victim. And the offender tends to be demanding and manipulative and secretive. That's one little thing we know. Now, the reason I'm going to be kind of generic about that is there's a whole lot of psychologists will tell you that you cannot come up with a psychological profile of an offender. And in one sense, that's true. You cannot give them an MMPI and say, he'll have a high 4-9 scale, and that may be jargon, it doesn't mean, because you can't. You cannot give a test and say, this one's an offender and this one's not. Can't do that. That's not possible. But there are some patterns that we know. We do know that in that kind of dynamic, there is manipulation, there is power abuse, there is vulnerability, and we know that that dynamic gets going. Same dynamic gets going in the school. Same dynamic gets going in the church. What happens many times, I can name probably 10 churches right now that I've had dealings with, but I can also name 5 that haven't done it that way, and I'm really thankful for that, is you will have an offender, whether, I'm thinking of one fellow that I work with right now, youth minister, who offended 20 young women in his congregation over a 4-year period of time. You can have an offender, you'll have the non-offending partner, which will be the church, or the congregation, or the body, and you'll have the victim. Now what happens in the non-offending partner is they tend to be very codependent. And what we know from all our alcoholism studies is that codependent people don't deal with the issue. One of the things that happens in many churches, and I ask that this book be here, and so, like you said, I'm going to mention it. This is it's a horrible story. You don't want to read that book, and yet it's a really good. Have you read that book? And she's a really neat lady. It's nothing sacred that Marie Fortune wrote this book. I was working with a pastor who said to me halfway through it, he said, that thing's pornographic. I will never, ever read that book again, and I'll never come see you again for telling me to read that. I later found out that he had sexually molested his granddaughter, which was interesting, but he wouldn't read that book because that talks about some instances in the church. And another book that I brought, which I'm not going to talk about or suggested you read, is Contrary to Love, which deals more with sexual addiction, which is a concept that for a whole lots of folks is very new. And I'm not saying that everyone who offends is addicted. Some are. And there is that kind of addiction like there is addiction to alcohol. But I've got to shy away from that now or I'll never get through where I want us to go tonight. At any rate, in Marie Fortune's book and in some of my experience and in several school districts that I've worked with, even though I stamp my feet and I jump up and down and I scream and holler and I do everything I can, I will say that healing and restoration will only come, it may not come, but the only chance it's got to come for both the offender and for the non-offending partner is for the offender to completely break secrets and really get it out in the open, and for the non-offending partner to break secrets helps the non-offending partner to break the codependency. But what happens in school districts and in churches quite often is once we've got it nailed and it's out in the open and you know that somebody did something, whether it was someone with a secretary or was with a child or wasn't with a child or whoever, and they're willing to resign, it's let's get them out of here, buy a few sessions of counseling for the victim, let's get this, now let's get healed and let's have forgiveness and let's move on. And it never really comes out in the open and the body never really deals with it. So there's all this dysfunctional stuff running around. I talked to a pastor yesterday who said, oh, I wish I was going to be here, because he said, I took a church where that had happened. And he said, can you send me something? I said, well, the things I'm going to say will be on tape. But he said, you know, can you imagine what it's like when you come in to another congregation and you take the church over and nobody tells you that that's what happened before? There's just incredible pain and agony. And so now there's a lot of pain breaking secrets and bringing it out in the open. A lot of pain, a lot of work, difficult to do. But if you walk away with one action step from here tonight, if you have any knowledge of that in your own congregation, in another congregation, if there's no other principle to work with than that one, then say, somebody told me one time, let's get the secrets out in the open. Let's bust it wide open. And let's don't let anybody, for any really good reason, and there will be 1,000 of them, say, look, we've had enough of this. Let's just get it quiet and let it move on. The price you pay, I will guarantee you, and the agony for everybody, and particularly the victims, because in these kinds of cases, my experience is invariably the victim winds up on trial. And the victim winds up getting crucified. And the pastor winds up, if it's a pastor, quite often being the person who has a gathering of people who support him or her, and it becomes very, very difficult to break that. And so what we tend to do is say, oh, this is too painful, it's too much, they're going to resign anyway. And you ought to see the references that come to the next place, because you want them to go somewhere, you don't want to stay there, so you write benign references and hope that nobody ever catches on. And it's an awful system. Not in all cases, thank you. It really isn't in all cases, I'm glad. The Los Angeles Times in 1985 did a survey that I'm going to just quote a couple things out of. And there's a book by John Crutzen, won a Pulitzer Prize in 1988. It's called By Silence Betrayed. And if you want to ever read a book that's got a lot to do with several of the big cases, the McMartin case in California and so forth, great amount of detail in there. But some of the things that they said in those two publications, one is that 22% of all Americans, that's male and female, will be abused, sexually abused, by the time they're 21 years of age. That 35% of all women in America will be sexually assaulted in some manner by the age 18. 35%, that's a lot of folks. And that one third of all of these assaults don't get reported. So we know we've got a substantial number of people that are dealing with these kinds of issues. The problem crosses all classes and cultures. Let me state that any sexual contact, when one member of the equation, and I said equation because I don't want to say relationship, because it's not a relationship. It's not a relationship when it's power abusive. Now let me stop right there and say what often happens, I'll refer back to the television show that I did with that one pastor. What often happens is he can say, with tears coming down out of his face, and in as much honesty that you could pass a polygraph, and say, but they came on to me. I didn't do anything. And I'll talk tomorrow about this grooming pattern that gets in, but what happens in many cases is, I kind of think of it as the person, whether it's a pastor, or whether it's a school teacher, or whether it's a whatever. It's sort of like you get seductive and your hands are kind of behind your head, but you sort of innuendo and this, that, and the other, and then when the person gets ready to make a move, it's like, I didn't really do anything, they initiated it. And I always somehow picture that with your hands up behind your head, and they kissed me first, and gosh, then we were off the races and there's nothing I could do about it. And so forth and so on, except we both had to pray together to say we shouldn't tell anybody, even though I was doing this with six other people, and all of those kinds of things. But it's not a relationship, and when one member of the equation is contacted sexually, it's sexual misconduct. And there always is more power, either by position or by age or by station or by knowledge. And the last thing I want to say about that is it's not a male-female issue. And interestingly enough, and I alluded to this before, as far as I'm concerned, it's not a genital issue. We're not talking about homosexual or heterosexual, and we're really not talking about, maybe this is more graphic than I should be, but what I usually say is, it's not what's between your legs we're talking about, it's what's between your ears. A friend of mine who runs the sex offender program at Twin Rivers in the state of Washington, up in Monroe at the prison, made a comment which I wholeheartedly agree with, but it seems to carry more weight when she says it than when I say it, and that's that when people talk about castration and all that kind of thing, which is folly anyway, because there's no research that shows that there's any validity in that, but she said, but if they were going to cut something, they're cutting at the wrong end. You know, you got to cut up here, maybe a frontal lobotomy or something, but we're talking about issues of power and of need and of self-esteem and those kinds of things, which you don't really change by surgery. If you take the, well, I'm going back to the two references that I made, the book by Silence Betrayed and the LA Times survey. They worked it out to where they came to a frightening amount, a frightening statistic, and that was that probably one male in 25 in our society, for whatever reason, and I've talked with anthropologists who will tell you that there are society after society after society where this is not true, but that in our society, these 22% and 35% are being of women that are being offended either by rape or by acquaintance rape or by molest or by whatever power abuse in their church or in their school. That's happening by about 1 out of 25 males in our society. And, you know, all you have to do, of course, statistics are so crazy, so you can't pay attention to that, but if you've got a group of you that's got 2,000 people in it, you've got X number of people who are potential offenders. But if you've got 4,000, if you've got 400 up here, and you know, you just have to pay attention to those kinds of statistics and either be scared of it or... I'll come back to the thing that I said before, which I just have to strongly hit one more time, and that is that somehow we in our society have this picture that even though we know better, even though we're better educated, that people who cross sexual lines, unless it was my Uncle Charlie, are probably people that look different, act different, and are out there somewhere. And they're not. They're the people that that I meet with, that I pray with. I was in a prayer and fellowship group with a guy for 2 years who at that time was setting up special ed kids in prostitution rings and being sexual with them himself. And classic, as often happens in that case, when that particular school district found out about that individual, they gave him 10 days to resign. He resigned, and he moved to a position with the state, working with developmentally disabled children. And on and on. You know, we all know horror stories like that. So it's kind of like Pogo, you know. The enemy is, we found him, and he's us. You know, it's right here amongst us, and we want to pay some attention to that. Now, what I'd like you to do, just to take, and I'll speak to the tape center people, I'd like you to group for 7, 8, 9 minutes right now. Take those little slips of paper and get in groups of 3 or 4. We do that real quick, you can make 3 or 4 groups. And I want to ask you to do something. And I'd like to have the person in your group who is sitting nearest to me record. Just so we don't have to spend 6 minutes deciding who the recorder is. The person nearest to me record. Keep the group small, no more than 3 or 4, because I don't want to take much time with this. Thanks, you guys are quick movers anyway. I'd like you to talk in your little group for just a few minutes about any instances that you know of this kind of behavior in the church, of sexual misconduct. In the church, if you know it. If not in the church, then through Uncle Charlie. If not through Uncle... But I'm not interested in what you heard on TV with Jimmy Swaggart or something like that. Something you know personally. And just share a couple of anecdotes and maybe somebody jot them down so I can look at them on the paper. Would you do that? And I'm saying to the tape recording people that right now, for the next 6 or 7 minutes, the groups are talking, so we're not. Goodbye. You're up. Okay, it sounds like, reading your notes, that most of you live in the same place I live. I mean, I always get scared that either you've never experienced that or you didn't want to tell me. But looking at your notes, it sounds like most of you have run into some situations like that. And you know, I sort of feel like a pathologist friend of mine who studies slides, you know, and most of the slides he sees are benign, and every now and then he gets one that's got cancer and he gets excited. I mean, he's weird. But Well, I mean, you look at 3,000 benign slides, and finally you're looking for something in malignant, and yet you don't think about it. It's almost like, I don't want to see anything, or I don't want to hear that there's a malignancy there, and yet the truth is I know there's a malignancy there. And it sounds like that most of you have been touched by that one way or the other. I'll talk more during the week, or sure be willing to chat with you. I do a lot of work in this area. I have a lot of contacts around the country. I'm going to shift now to some particular patterns of individuals, but I'll sure be glad to be a resource to you, listen to you, suggest some things you can try, some things that don't work very well. But due to our time, let me shift it a bit to... Thanks. Drop it and I'll just... Oh, good. Thanks. Let me shift it to... talking something about patterns again on individuals who do cross those kinds of sexual misconduct lines. And in your notes, I got lots of different examples of different ages and strata, and it just sort of fit like we did have a good mix. And I'll work that into some things I'm doing later on in the week. This is a thing that Pat Carnes put together. And it's something that I have experienced to be very valid. Pat Carnes wrote, that is out of this book, Out of the Shadows. He's a fellow back in Minneapolis, and I've worked a lot with him and know him pretty well, and I found that core belief system to be pretty valid. The book that I suggested be up here is this one, Contrary to Love. Pat wrote that book also. It just gives you a pretty good idea about the person who has addiction problems. And I'm not going to talk too much about that other than to say that everybody who crosses sexual misconduct lines is not addicted, but lots of people are. And I want to say that in the same context that everybody that drinks a lot is not alcoholic. Some people drink a lot and aren't alcoholic, and some people drink a lot and are alcoholic. And we don't really have time to play with that difference tonight. But I have found this to be really... a valid construct to look at, and it plays very much into this secrecy thing that I said is so important to break to change that pattern. And that is that the basic belief is that I'm a bad person, I'm an inadequate person, I'm an unworthy person, I'm flawed. I'll talk in a minute a little more about the narcissistic personality, and one of the things that I want to say that overwhelmingly is true is that it's very, very difficult to tell if this person is an overcoming narcissist or someone who just feels real bad about themselves. When we work with teacher revocations, in this state at least, and I work a lot with the Superintendent Public Instruction Office on teacher revocations for teachers, and that number of revocations is going up dramatically in the state of Washington for sexual misconduct. And some of you will laugh at this, and I don't, because I think it's terrible, because I spent a number of years, six of them, as a high school football coach, and I loved that part of my life, and I think it was really neat. But the number one group of people in the state of Washington that get their license as a teacher revoked are coaches. That's number one. And the number two group are the music people, and then number three group are the counselors. Now, that all makes sense if you think about it, because they have the most access to kids. But the thing that I'm trying to make a point of is that often the person who is involved in sexual misconduct is your teacher or your pastor or your youth pastor or someone who's really dynamite. Now, they may have this kind of an issue going, that they're a bad person, that they're an inadequate person, but they're also an intelligent person and a driven person. And I don't know if any of you play golf, but there are good golfers and there are scramble golfers. I'm a scramble golfer. I'm always in trouble, but I'm scrambling and trying twice as hard as anybody else to get back. This person's a scrambler. And in that scrambling and trying very hard to be adequate, they may rise right to the top, and they may be... often the best teacher on the staff, I worked with a youth pastor who had a nationally recognized youth program, nationally recognized. And he'd spent a number of years with Young Life, and I spent a younger number of years with Young Life. And I hated that because I like Young Life. I don't want that to get that kind of name. But he was dynamite. He also, when you worked with him in therapy for a few months, you knew how true that was. Just incredible feelings of inadequacy coming out of his pain and lots of stuff that had happened in his own abuse as a child and so forth and so on. Second thing is, no one would love me as I am. And what we mean by that is, if I told you everything, if I told you all my secrets, if I told you the stuff I do, if I told you the stuff I think about, if I told you, there's no way you could accept me. And you really get a double dip on this if you're a Christian. And then you get a triple dip on it if you're a pastor. Because if you've got a secret life, that you're driving downtown and going to the porno flicks, or you're molesting people in your congregation, but you know that God has forgiven you, and you ought to be above all this, but you're not. And how many times, and I can't tell you the number of times when I've met with pastors, and the tears are genuine. I mean, they hurt like you can't believe it, because I'm going to lose my church, I'm going to lose. And the pain is incredible. Oh, at the moment, doesn't stop anything. I'll talk tomorrow about a cycle that you get into. No, it absolutely does not stop anything. It'll put in remission, depending on how bad the pain is, it may put it in remission for a week or a month or a year, but it doesn't stop it. It just puts it in remission. The remorse, psychologically you said, is it genuine? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. That gets tricky too, but the pain's genuine. It really is. So, I'm an inadequate person deep down, even though on the surface I may be the best teacher in the group or have the best youth program or whatever. Nobody would love me, not if I told you all my stuff. There's no way. Remember the movie, I just loved it. I didn't understand any of this stuff then, but the movie Four Seasons with Alan Alda and everybody was such a beautiful example, where Alan Alda and this other guy were going through this thing about, tell me, remember that scene, some of you nodded yes, well, tell me what the problem is. His best buddy for years and years and years wanted to know. But when he told him he was having an affair, I don't want to hear that anymore. I don't even like you anymore. It's like the minute he said, I'll be open, I'll love you no matter what, but you tell him that you're molesting kids or you're doing, I don't like you anymore. I don't. And that's the fear that this person has. It's probably a pretty valid fear. Okay, the third one is, my needs are never going to be met if I depend on others. Can you see how that fits into two things? One, compulsive masturbation, because that's a secretive act. The other one is, I've got to depend on me. People I can't trust. I've got to be solitary. I cannot. Well, that keeps you in the secret world. It keeps a whole package here going all by itself, and it keeps you from breaking out of that. Whereas, and I'll say it over and over, and I'll say it all week, you got to bring the light to this. In the darkness is death. This has to come to the light, and it has to come to the light both for the offender and for the non-offending partner, which can be the congregation or whoever it is. So, and then the fourth one is, sex is my most important need. And with any addiction, you can switch this. Cocaine is my most important need. Whatever is my most important need. But I want to shift that now and talk a little bit about need. Because my experience with people that get into these kind of problems is that they have an incredible misunderstanding of wants and needs. Did I do it? No, I didn't do it yet. All right, let's... Oh, look at that. I finally got there. Because of time, I'm not going to do what I like to play with. Sometimes I like to have you take the little pieces of paper and make up lists, but maybe you can just call out to me and help me out. What I do here is I call this a need-want continuum. And I'm building a package now about people that get into sexual misconduct. And I'm saying one thing is that they're often high intense, scrambling people who are working real hard to achieve, but deep down are feeling real inadequate. I'm saying that there's a whole lot of manipulation and secrecy involved in it, and you may wonder why you can't get real close to them, because you can't. Not that they don't want you to, but you can't, because there's got to keep a distance, because there's a whole secret world going. I'm saying that one of the things they get really mixed up on is what they need and what they want in life. And Mary was talking about that earlier in a whole different context, but I put it into my need-want thing. Everybody in our staff teases me about even saying the word need and want, and it's like we don't play with that word. But I talk about, just for starters, a continuum of intensity, an emotional thermometer going from here to here, and just conceptually to try to say that if this is what I want, and this is what I need, just to get the idea in your head that you can want something as bad as you need it. Just to get that idea across to you. Just to change your consciousness a little bit. That I can want chocolate so bad. Or I can want alcohol. Or I can want sex. Or I can want whatever. But what happens when I get blurred, and people with the sexual misconduct problems always get blurred, boundaries get real crazy, and they can't keep the boundary straight. They get real confused with what they need and what they want. And it gets real blurry for them, and they cannot keep that straight. So one of the things that I try to affirm is that you can want something so bad. Remember when you were, well, John was talking last night about, I love that example of being in love and the yoke being lighter when you're in love. But take another aspect of it. Remember, maybe you still are, when you have that in love kind of thing, and it's almost disgusting, the psychological studies have been done, because when you're in that state, your complexion's better, your bowel movements are more regular, everything works. Everything works. It makes me mad. You know, wouldn't it be nice to be there all the time? When you're in that state of that just crazy state of in-loveness, can you remember how much you want to be with that person and you drive a half an hour? I can remember doing that just to get to talk face-to-face for 10 minutes and drive back, and it's so intense and so, but you don't need that. You want that. And I'm trying to get across the point that you can want it as much as you can need it. So I put down here some things that you want, and then I contrast that with some things that you need. There aren't very many things that you need. Very, very few. You need air. What are some more things you need that you cannot exist without?
Water.
You got to have water. Yep, you'll go pretty quick. What else?
Food.
Yeah, I've got to have some kind of nutrition. Keep the engine going.
Sleep.
What?
Sleep.
Sleep? Absolutely.
Shelter.
Some kind of shelter. Yeah, your body, something to keep your body temperature. It can't go too much up or too much down, or, okay, we're starting to run out though. The list goes much more. What else?
Maybe touch.
Okay, you do need touch, and I kind of equate touch and love and all that stuff, but then I draw the line with sex. Now, there's been a lot of studies done that have said not only babies, there's a wonderful study that came out of the Korean War, which talked about what brainwashing, the true term brainwashing, really meant, where they isolated people, separated them apart, and there's some real psychological dynamite damaging tactics they use to isolate people. But if you isolate people enough where they don't get touched emotionally or physically, they die. They die. You will die if you get emotionally and physically isolated. But you don't need to be touched genitally. One of the things that we do with people that come into our program is, oh, everybody hates this, but you have to go 120 days without any kind of sexual contact. People are saying, you gotta be kidding. I masturbate 5 times a day. You're gonna tell me I'm gonna go 120 days? But it's amazing if you don't have to have sex, but you do have to have touch. You do have to have emotional and physical touch. But how's the rest of the list? See, I don't think I know anything else. That you need those things. You don't get those things, you shrivel up. Now, on the one end, we got a lot of things, and we're not going to take time to. Well, let's do three. Tell me three things you want. You may not get them, but you want them.
Chocolate.
Ice cream. Yeah. Okay. So you follow what I'm saying? The person that gets caught in this loses that boundary completely. Now what I say is, if you guys wanted to do this, we're going to play, you got a psychologist sitting here, so you're going to play this fun little game, and there's probably enough of you here to do it, although it would take quite a few. We're going to do a sensory deprivation exercise with Bill Lemon. What we're going to do is we're going to hold him down right here. We're going to hold him down, put some pillows under him, put some pillows over him, and we're going to take his air away. Now, in the beginning, and this is real crucial to me to get across to you, in the beginning, if I went along with it, it would be okay. You put some pillows there for me where I wouldn't get hurt, and then you'd hold me down, and then you put a pillow over my face, and maybe for about 60 seconds or maybe for about 90 seconds, it would be okay. At that point in time, in my mind, I believe I need air. I believe I need air. I will now begin to do some things with you. And this is what the person who gets involved with all the sexual misconduct issues gets into. The belief is that since I need air, I will manipulate you, I'll bargain with you, but you keep holding me down and pretty soon I'll hurt you. I don't care about you anymore. I've got to have what I got to have because I need it. I need air. At that point in time, somewhere within 2 or 3 minutes, I'll kill you. I don't care about you anymore because you are depriving me of what I need, and I will do anything to you to get what I need. I become very desperate to get my fix, to get what I have to have. Well, with air, that's true. I have to have it. With the self-esteem fix that comes from, and that gets real weird to figure out how in the world that could happen. But when I get into a state where I believe that my lust fix comes from someone who's vulnerable to me, affirms me in a sexual way, and then we get into a tricky other little switch thing here. My objectivity goes up and my empathy goes down. My objectivity goes up and my empathy goes down. And that's what happens to me when you hold me down and I don't have air. You are no longer a person to me. My objectivity goes up, you're depriving me of what I want, and my empathy goes down. My feeling for who you are as a person. I have a friend who's a surgeon, and prior to being a surgeon, he kind of laughs. He says he tried to save the world through religion, and for him it didn't work because he used to be a youth pastor, and then he went into being a drug counselor, and that didn't work, and then he became a doctor, and I don't know if this one's working or not, but he's got a thing to do what he can for the world. But he was fearful because he thought, I don't know how to cut on people because I care about them. But he learned. You don't cut on a person, you cut on an appendix. That's real important for a surgeon, that your objectivity goes up and your empathy goes down. How in the world do you think a nice guy, and the classic line that I get when I talk to offenders, I've heard it, I can't tell you how many times, what kind of a guy do you think I am? Well, I don't laugh and say, we already know what kind of a guy. I don't say that. You know, the pain is so great because what's happened when they lose the boundary between need and want and they get real confused about boundaries, the objectivity goes up and then they begin to convince themselves. They set me up. They came after me. They wanted it anyway. It was good for them. You know, you fill in the blanks as to all the things as the objectivity goes up and the empathy goes down. One of the things you have to do in therapy, and it has to start with breaking the secrets, and the world's got to know about it. One of the things that has to happen is the empathy has to go up and the objectivity has to go down. You have to get the person, force the person, and I don't know very many people short of pressing that issue that are willing to go through that kind of hard work to be able to get some sense of what their behavior has caused to the other person. I'll finish this part, tonight's part, on a note like that, and I tell them, and it's awful, you can't ever fix your last victim. You don't get another chance at that. You know, you sowed something and you reap that. That you can't ever go back and make that one better again. What you can do is work on making where the pattern stops and you don't do that again to somebody else. I don't know if this is fair, but we started 4 minutes late, so let's talk, ask questions for 4 minutes and we'll scram for Vespers. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Paint us an ideal scenario.
A world where we don't have sexual misconduct.
Yeah, I know. But let's say that that's taking place in a parish. And, paint the picture of how that might play itself out so that all would benefit the most from that. How would you paint the picture?
We worked with the church,
yeah.
In which I think it was handled about as ideal as I know how, and I think real healing took place. One of the things we did was get the victims all together, all 15 or 20 of them, and we began meeting with them on a regular basis. Another thing we did was, and the church called us in and asked us to do all this. Another thing we did was we spoke briefly, and not just myself, some other people, because I wasn't working with the victims in that case, and the pastor spoke specifically from the pulpit, not during the sermon time, but and said, you know, without naming names, but we put a prepared speech, which we all agonized over as to what to say, so that it wasn't shaming and condemning, but was honest, and we worked at it, and the council worked with us and made some statements from the pulpit. We had Sunday evening meetings for as long as people wanted to come in and just express their pain, and that started with 150 people, and about 6 weeks later got down to about 8, and we met with those 8 for as long as they wanted to meet. We had victim meetings. We